Hi, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Spotlight. And as is tradition, I'd like to begin by thanking Becky for all her hard work behind the scenes, and to Dennis for doing the recording for archive purposes. And on this occasion, I've got another of our For the People members to introduce you to. He's known on the site as SWL Snooper, and the reason for that will become apparent later on in the interview. But his family and friends know him better as Ronnie Sanders. Ronnie, can I welcome you to Spotlight and thank you for the interview, and begin by asking you where and when you were born.
Well, thank you, Steve. I was born in Bowling Green, Kentucky, which is about 120 miles southwest of, actually 120 miles which is from Louisville, Kentucky, which is southwest of, northeast of Bowling Green, and I'm about 60 miles north of Nashville, Tennessee, and that's where I was born. Went to school in Louisville, Kentucky, at the age of 8. I went to Kentucky School for the Blind in Louisville, and that was about a 2 or more hour trip by car. We couldn't go to school where I was born.
And your parents, just tell us a little bit briefly about your mum and dad. What did they do? And have you have any brothers and sisters?
I have a mother who is living. She's 75 years old. She is has a lung disease at the moment, but she's managing to do pretty well. She's on oxygen therapy. My father, he died up to 1977. He was 56, and he worked on cars. He did work on automobiles, did painting, sanding, and other kinds of automotive work. And I have a twin brother who is the same age I am. We were both premature. I was born in 54, so hence I'm 48 years old. And he has a little vision problem. I was born blind due to too much oxygen in the incubator. And he's had glasses. He has only one good eye now due to other things that's happened. And I have a sister who lives in Indiana. And she is about 50 years old. Go ahead.
So your twin brother was sighted, well, as near as sighted, and you were blind. Obviously, that means that, am I right in assuming then that he didn't have to go to school for the blind, but you did?
That's correct. He went to public school. He went to a local high school in Bowling Green, Kentucky at the time. We lived away from the city about 4.5 to 5 miles. And he went to a high school there and graduated. He went through the full 12 years, and he had to wear glasses and have his books made to where he could read the larger print.
The fact that you'd got a twin brother with a little sight problem and you were totally blind, did it cause any friction between you two as twins? I mean, was it difficult for you to accept the fact that your twin brother could see and you couldn't?
Well, we fought off and on. We would get into fights when we were younger. But the situation was that I didn't react the same as most people who could see. And that's when we found out, my mother and father found out that I was blind. Yes, there was the normal kidding, making fun of things. He would talk about me being blind and not being able to see. His personality was different from mine. He has a different personality, different from night and day between me and him, a difference between us there. But he was more of the impatient type. He seemed to be less patient, trying to show me certain things, teach me. I was only there during the weekends, because when I came home from Louisville, I came home like every two or three weeks for a weekend, then I had to go back to Louisville when I was going to school. So the only time that I really spent a lot of time around him was during the summer when they had 3 months between June to September. Those were the days where, you know, you had 3 months straight and you could do what you wanted to do at home. Other than that, I was away from him for periods of time, for a month or more at a time.
What are your early memories of life pre-school? Were you an adventurous child? Were you restricted in what you were allowed to do? Or was it a pretty free and easy life for you before you had to go to residential school?
Well, I guess it was somewhat restrictive because I always hung around my mother and my father at that time. I was not a real curious person to, I guess if I did get into trouble, I don't remember a lot of my early preschool life at that time. I used to fool around with radios, transistor radios, and mess with the TV set and, you know, the occasional, don't bother that. But I was inquisitive as far as radio equipment was concerned, how it worked, and I've had my share of dropped transistor radios. I had one instance where I had one fall into water and would not work, you know. So basically, it was pretty well tame life at home, and my mother seemed to be the one that I was most attentive to. My father worked, and he came home in the evenings, and he was a little bit more impatient, and my mother was a little bit more loving as far as showing me how to do certain things and how to get dressed.
So, at the age of eight, then, you went to boarding school for the blind. Was it a big shock to your system? How did you find that experience? Can you remember those early days?
Well, I was shocked. I didn't want to go away from home, and it was something to get adjusted to, because I'd always been around my mother and father, and the normal things that happen where you do not get adjusted, you cry a little bit, and you sort of wish I didn't have to be here. I wish I could have gone to school at home, near home. And the thing that I found out when I was going to school, that there were some people that lived right in the same town, and they could go home every day. They were what they call day students, you know. They came to school during the daytime and got home at night. And I had to get used to a new set of house parents, a lady who was a house parent, and I had to get used to a new way of doing things, getting up in the morning, going to school, going to bed at a certain time, and having to be prompted to get up in the morning, and the normal routine that you go through when you get ready for school. And it was hard to adjust, and there was a period of time that I sat out from school because I couldn't adjust very well due to some things that happened, which I, you know, would not want to go into, but to say that I had to be encouraged, and I had to be, as it were, coaxed, as it were, to try to do what I was told to do and adjust to going to school.
So would you say it was a strict regime at school for the blind, Ronnie? I mean, were they kindly towards you, would you say, or did you find it really, really tough going when you were a small child?
I would say it was pretty well kind to me. It was just a matter of getting used to new people, getting used to certain things that you had to do, like getting up and eating at a certain time, going to bed at a certain time, and then having to get along with other boys that were younger or older, probably, you know, same age or older than you were. We had like as many as, I think, 20 boys. We had about as many as 20 boys. We had four cottages for boys and girls, two for girls, two for boys. And we had, I was in what they call the little boys area, little boys cottage at that time. And it was just a matter of having to get used to doing things with the kids, talking and talking to them, and watching what you did, is, in other words, so you wouldn't get in trouble. Just having to get used to people who didn't like the same things that you liked and everything. It was basically the normal thing of having to adjust to like your own world at home and having to adjust to new surroundings.
So what subjects did you particularly warm to at school, Ronnie? What did you like to actually do, and what didn't you like doing in the, you know, in the lessons field?
Well, I did not care much for the language grammar, English grammar at times. I didn't care a lot for the science, social studies, and things that, you know, you took when you were little. When I was in the kindergarten, when I started out in kindergarten, we just had basically stories. We had little, I guess, like Snow White and all the other fairy tales that you had when you were going to kindergarten. And then you would have juice and maybe a snack. And then you had to go to dinner at lunchtime. You had to go to your cottage at that time to go to your place. We had a building later on built for everybody to eat food there. But in the beginning, I went to the place where I had my a dormitory. It was a dormitory. We had nightstands and everything else in there, and everybody had its own bed, a little space, and we all shared a bathroom there upstairs. But the subjects that I guess I didn't care as much for were basically the English and sometimes reading, until I got to where I could read better. It was people had I had to be helped at times reading the Braille, and those were subjects that I had to get used to. I think my favorite as time went on was mathematics, and the spelling. I guess spelling was good for me. I was good at spelling, but it was hard for me to write sometimes make up sentences and things that I had to do in the grammar.
So, did you stay at Louisville in Kentucky School for the Blind all of your school life, or do you move on at a later stage to another school?
No, I stayed there for 10 years. I skipped two grades and did my 12 years and 10 years. So, I stayed at that school for my whole time when I first enrolled in about 1963. I graduated in 73. And I did not transfer anywhere. All my books were provided there in Braille, along with the writing equipment and the meals, and of course the later on study hall time that you had to have when you did your homework. And that was a drag at one point, Steve, where you used to do work 5 days a week. And we used to be pretty much free to do what we wanted to on the weekends, but when you got in the higher grades, working on the weekends, having to do homework to turn in on Monday was a drag, and it was something that I had to get used to. For the 10 years, it was all there. I graduated in 73 and had I'd say, a very good report card. I averaged some A's and B's. Pretty well made a high grade before I went to college.
During your last period at school, say during the last, I don't know, 2 years, 1 year, were you given any careers advice, or had you got any idea of what you wanted to pursue as a job yourself?
Well, I never really got much career advice at the time that I went to school. We did have a discussion about guide dogs, seeing eye dogs, and I get around with a cane. But as far as the vocation, I don't remember much discussion. I took piano tuning as a trade, a class when I was in my senior, junior and senior years. Each year I took it for about probably three years or four, and I took it under a blind instructor. But basically what they did with most people was when they graduated them, they told them about how they could go about getting a dog or go about possibly going into a trade profession, but not a lot of guidance, not a lot of encouragement about going to college.
You mentioned piano tuning there. Was that a structured course that you could take at the School for the Blind? Because over here in the UK, you would actually go to a separate place to do the piano tuning. Just briefly tell us a little bit about your piano tuner training.
Well, we took a piano tuning in the school building where we had a new building built back in the late '60s, and there was a piano tuning department downstairs, and a blind instructor taught the class, and we had a piano that we could practice on. They had built rooms. Actually, there was more than one piano to work on, but there were practice rooms where there would be as many as maybe four or five students, and the instructor would tell us how to know how to work on a part of the piano, like the hammers, the felts, the action work, which required some vision but could be felt. We did work with stringing a piano, as far as the piano being turned over on its back to do the big strings, the bass strings, and then as you know, on a piano there are over 230 strings, and as you go up higher the strings get smaller, and down lower they get bigger. And we had to learn how to string a piano, how to put the pins in, how to hammer them in, and so forth. I did not do much of the repair because my fingers are sweaty, but we had to read about how to do the various strings, the octaves, unisons, temperament pattern tuning a piano, and how to set the pitch with a tuning fork, and how to put a piano back together again when we took the top off and the front panel off. To get to the strings, how we could use felts to strip the piano so that only certain strings would sound until we took the knees out.
Absolutely fascinating, Ronnie. I've seen the piano tuned and it's something that absolutely fascinates me, and I know it's a very skilled job, but obviously you didn't pursue that as a career, so let me take you now out of school, and what happened next? What was the next significant thing to happen in your life after you left school?
Well, after I graduated from Kentucky School for the Blind in 73, I went to college for 5 years. My major, since I liked radio and TV, was mass communications, which has to do with not just the broadcast media, which, radio like the BBC or the local networks, ABC, CBS, NBC, the local channels, local TV and radio broadcasting, but also the print media, the magazines, newspapers, and the various electronic media. The internet, of course, was not there at that time in 73 to 78, but that was my major, and I wanted to get into a job in doing radio announcing work, broadcasting. It never panned out, but I had a Bachelor of Arts degree at Western Kentucky University, Bowling Green, Kentucky, and my minor was in speech communication, which was somewhat related to mass communication because you have to be able to speak and have your message come across so that people understood what you were talking about and be able to speak in a public setting, which was not too bad for me being blind, so I didn't have to worry about looking at the audience and knowing how I would be received. That was a plus in sense being blind, because you didn't have to worry about the looks, though you wanted to be prepared and be able to talk for a period of time on a subject. But shall I say, jokingly, I never had to worry about someone throwing eggs at me.
Yeah, okay. This radio training you had, did you get any practical experience at radio stations announcing? And was your brief to write news reports and stories like in a journalistic way? Is that what you were doing at the time?
Yes, at times we had some experience with journalism, but at the time that I was in beginning classes of mass communications, we had basically a headline of a newspaper story, what they would call the lead, or a few sentences about the story. And what we would have to do is organize it in such a way, such as using the word today instead of yesterday, or bringing it up to a point where the action was in the present rather than saying this happened yesterday, this and this happened in London, at whatever the location of the story was. So we had to make it current, and we had to make it pretty much fit how it would be done as far as a broadcast situation would be concerned. When I worked at the radio station, I did the records, I was the DJ, and I had to keep a log. I had to have someone sighted to fill the log out for me when we played music that we had to stay in a certain format. We had certain color-coded records that we had to play. We had certain commercials and announcements that had to be read, which in my case had to be put in Braille, and I had to come in an hour or more earlier to get my text together and to know how we were going to do the announcement or announcements, and they changed. They changed on sometimes a weekly basis, because I might work 1 or 2 days a week for 3 hours, and I had someone, another male or female student, help me keep within the formats and help me with certain things that I might have trouble with while I was on the air.
Very interesting. Would you say, all things being equal, that you would have liked to pursue a career in radio? Is it something which you would have really relished in doing? I mean, obviously it didn't turn out for you because, as you say, technology isn't there like it is today. It would be very different today. But would you really have loved to have been in radio?
Yes, I would have. I would have loved it. Had the technology that we have been there in the past, I would have probably gotten some opportunities at radio stations. But due to the nature of the job situation and it being competitive, the issue that would come up with a manager would be, well, why do I need to hire two people when I can have one person do it all, that can see and he can do everything that's needed that is needed to be done. And it was more of an economic, I think, situation for an else out opportunity. But as I reflect on it, and the way the meat to be told about a story is in our country, and I may have been better off not getting into it, because express something that otherwise been better unsaid rather than spoken.
So when you realized, Ronnie, that radio wasn't going to be for you, what did you do after that? What was the next significant turning point in your work career?
Well, I graduated from college in 1978. I did piano tuning work part-time when I was in Bowling Green. But the next major work that I did was I moved to Anniston, Alabama at the end of 1981. I had an uncle who was living at the time, my father's brother, who's no longer living now. And he got me on at a military installation called Anniston Army Depot. And he got me on in the handicapped program, where I did work in the small arms shop where I'm working. And I had to go through the physical requirements. I had to be tested for hearing. I had to take the requirements as far as the urine specimen and the requirements that you have to do as far as being checked out, blood pressure check and everything else. And so I was given a good bill of health. I was employed there, and they accepted the application, which they helped me to fill out. My uncle and the people there at personnel with the government there helped me to fill it out. And I was sworn in on December 7th, and that's when my official work began at the Anson Army Depot. Oddly enough, sworn in on Pearl Harbor Day, for your interest.
Yes, December the 7th is an important day for people in the United States. I appreciate that. Now, obviously your job is very sensitive. There are aspects of your job which we can't talk about. So, if I ask you anything you can't answer, please, you know, please say, I can't answer that, and we'll all understand, because you are working with Army equipment, etc. So can you tell us what your job actually involves, Ronnie? What do you do on a day-to-day basis?
What I do on a day-to-day basis in my job is when I come in, I do opening of parts. I open parts or do work that's assigned to me. I have a supervisor and a lead man that come around, and they will tell me what we have to do, what parts we have to work up, and what they'll do is they'll set a container or a basket, anything for me, and they will put the parts for me to open, and they'll tell me where to put them. Well, if I take them out of the wrappers or out of the plastic or whatever, where to put the parts. And what I do in my basic job is I assist a higher employee, a higher grade employee, in the building and tear down of weapons parts. The weapons parts are basically taken to where they're cleaned up and they're made to look like new. Sometimes there are parts that cannot be used, that they are salvaged, and they get replacement parts for those particular gun parts that we have to work on. But basically, tear down, I use a hammer to punch, I can say that, and we have various containers to put the parts in that have to be metal finished, made new, and parts that must be gotten rid of, and they check them for visual inspection. They make sure that when I build, or especially in the building process, they make sure that what I build meets the requirements as far as the instructions about how to build a particular gun.
Do you work on any well-known weapons, you know, weapons which your average person in the street would have heard of?
Yes, I work on M16. That is one particular weapon that is widely heard in your news stories, such as like the war in Vietnam and at the Gulf War, where M16 is used. I have worked on pistols, certain, you know, like different caliber pistol weapons, machine guns. I don't work on all those, but certain ones that they help me to do the parts on, it is stuff that is safely can be handled. It is stuff that's not dangerous or harmful for me to pick up and move about or how to handle. So I work on two or three different guns, if nothing more, but just open parts and put them in containers and then have them ready for the person who is going to be using those parts later on in the reconstruction of the weapon.
Do you ever handle the rifle as complete, the M16? 'Cause I know absolutely nothing about weaponry at all, and I was just wondering if it was possible for you to give us an idea of the physical size of one of these things. I mean, how long is it, for instance, and how heavy is it? Can you tell us that?
Well, I have been around those particular guns, and I have held one, an M16. I believe, I can't remember for sure if it's, if they're 2.5 to 3 feet long, you know, they have a big barrel that sticks out, and they have a grip, they have a trigger, and various hardware that's on the gun. I have seen one put together, and they have basically one of the things, like most guns have a stock that you put up into your arm, you know, to shoot the gun. You have a stock and you have a grip and so forth on them. But I handle some of those parts as far as putting the parts on, or at least as far as opening them for someone else to put on. But yes, I've held M16, I've held some of the pistols, and I have seen some of the other machine guns and things that we work on. I have even seen some of the parts torn down on a particular gun. For educational purposes, they'll sometimes take me and I'll ask them, can you show me how this or this goes together, or what this looks like? And they will take me off my job and they'll take me to where they have a gun that's been being put together, and they'll show me how the receiver and the receiver and the lower part and the upper part go together.
Just a reminder for anyone who's joined us relatively recently, we're talking to Ronnie Sanders about his life and experiences. Any idea how many parts there are to a rifle?
I am not exactly sure of the number, but there are some small portions, small parts, as well as big parts. There might be as many as there might be between 50 and 100 parts or more of varying sizes. I would say, honestly, you know, on the, for example, the barrel, we have things we have to put on the barrel, and we have to there's a part that screws on them, and we have to do that, and we have to also other parts like washers and things that have to be put on them. So there may be anywhere from 50 or more parts on at least some of the guns that I work on. Some of them can be very, very small. Some of them are the size of a little, it can be the size of a pin, a small pin that you would put in something. Some of them can be as small as a little ball. But due to the size, you'd have to be very, very careful of them, because they could drop and you would never be able to find them.
So you have to be extremely careful that you don't lose the parts, because they're, you know, precision made, obviously, and probably extremely expensive as well. So your job then, just to get it straight, is you sort out all the various bits and pieces so that the guns can be serviced. Is that correct, Ronnie? Have I got that right?
That is correct. That is correct. And besides doing the sorting, there are some things they will have me to do, as far as putting maybe a spring on a particular part of a gun, or they'll have me to tear down a gun where I take the springs out, which are salvageable, and they'll have me to put the various pieces in containers. But there is some rebuild that I can do, but it's stuff that is to a point to where if it's something bad, I can salvage it or put it in a container that they will dispose of. Other things, they basically had me just to separate parts in different containers so that someone can, take them and, you know, put them where they're supposed to be put into a gun. But that's correct. I do tear down, rebuild, separation parts, opening parts, and basically those activities.
Can you tell us, and if you can't, I quite understand, just to say you can't answer that question if you can't, how much more complex is a machine gun to the M16?
I wouldn't know for sure. I have seen machine gun, but the parts are heavier. Some of the parts are lighter, but there is more of a physical weight requirement that I think that they have to handle. We have to wear safety shoes, by the way, in our job, even though I'm in an area where I have small parts. Parts are brought in when we go to the bathroom or go to the drink machine, we have to wear safety shoes. If something happens in the workplace, it would be complex if a machine gun part fell and, let's say, it hit me on the toe. The safety shoe would, the toe would keep me from damaging my foot. For safety reasons, we have to wear those. But as far as the guns are concerned, yes, I would say probably the machine gun and some of the other heavier weapons are a little bit more complex to put together. And in all these cases, we have to fire them. We have to make sure that they're accurate. And we have to make sure that when they're put together that there are no defects as far as the gun, you know, being put together. But yeah, I'd say a machine gun is probably a little bit more complex to put together than an M16.
Have all the weapons that you're dealing with seen active service with the military, with the American Army?
Well, I know of is maybe the M16, maybe the pistols and things that we use. We also work on tanks out there where we're at. Can't go into a lot of detail on that, but we also refurbish or we work on tanks, and we make sure that they function properly for the men and women in the service. So not only do we do in the shop that I'm in small arms, but we also do tanks and other military weaponry. So tanks also would be used as much in the Army as well.
I appreciate that you can't really talk too much about that. Now, a strange question for you, Ronnie, but I feel I ought to ask it. Does it ever cross your mind when you're actually doing your daily job that these pieces of equipment you're dealing with could easily be used to kill people?
Yes, it does. I think about it at times because we have security. We have security where we work. And one of the things that I did and sometimes may be asked to do sometimes is I have to load sometimes ammunition for a particular gun. And that is security. And we have to account for it. We have to, you know, make sure that when we load it, that we have what we've loaded, and when we fire the guns, they have to make sure that that's accounted for and used, you know. But yes, we have to be very careful who does the firing and the testing, and only certain people that are required can do that. So certain people who know their job can do that. They don't let just anybody do this or that, you know, testing, firing, loading ammunition and so forth. And we also have to make sure, of course, the personality and the temperament of the person. And we've never so far, we've been blessed, we haven't had any major situations. We've had some accidents. Sometimes it's happened at work due to a gun firing improperly or somebody getting hurt. But so far, we've never had a situation where someone has gotten out of control.
Did it take you very long to learn to recognize all the parts? You must be pretty dexterous with your hands because of the piano tuning experience you've had. Did it take you long to be able to recognize all these bits and pieces?
It took some time, Steve. It took a little bit of time because what we would do, the person assigning me to work would show me the gun parts, and he would tell me, you know, he would show me what it looks like and how we sometimes take a portion of a gun apart and how that part goes in and how that particular part sometimes may be broken down into various other parts that are put together with springs or various mechanisms. So it took a time to feel. I might say that our job is sort of a dirty job at times. In the teardown, it's dirty. You have a lot of dirt and oil and we could say carbon on the old parts. Some of the parts, when you tear them down, they're dirty and oily. And even when you rebuild a gun, when they get the dirt and stuff cleaned up and they re-oil and they get the parts ready for us to rebuild, even that can be a messy situation because the parts have to be oiled so they don't rust, and they have to have a reasonable amount of oil on them when the guns go together.
Yes, so I expect your hands take a bit of a hammering on a day-to-day basis with all this oil and stuff that you're dealing with on a day-to-day basis in your everyday job. Are you the only disabled person in the unit, or are there others?
There are some others. We have one individual who's in a wheelchair currently that has multiple sclerosis, and he works in our shop. We have another individual who will be retiring probably in December of this year. He had been there about 31, 32 years, and he was injured in Vietnam. His leg was blown off due to a landmine in Vietnam, and he has to wear a crutch, and he has to, I don't know if he uses a wheelchair, but he does have to have probably his prosthetic leg to get around. We have had someone else that had that was in a wheelchair years ago that did work. He's no longer there now. We had one or two other blind people. One of them died about 5, maybe 7, 8 years ago. I'm not sure. And he lost his vision when he was younger. The other one had could see well enough to get around, but he was injured at work and basically had to get out on disability. As far as I know, I and maybe a couple others in there are the only ones that I'm aware of that are disabled.
And you all get along pretty good. Would you say that you're treated equally by your sighted colleagues? Do you all get along, very well?
I would say yes. We get along pretty well. We, of course, get a little kidding now and then, a little joking about various things, but we get along pretty well. I'd say I'm treated equally with respect to my limitation. They're not going to have me do something that is going to endanger me or something that would be unsafe. As far as getting around, they've tried to teach me for a period of time. I had someone take me to the drink machine and to the bathroom, and up until about the last, 7, 8 years or more in my 21 years I've been there nearly now, they allowed me to get around with a cane at work. But I have people watch out for me because things change in the aisleway. So I'm not totally dependent on someone having to take me back and forth.
That's good to hear. That's really good to hear. And let's just now get away from work. What do you like to do in your spare time? Maybe you could tell the people in the room why the SWL Snooper. That's a strange screen name. But what do you like to do in your spare time, Ronnie?
Well, in my spare time from work, I am a snooper, just like my screen name. I am a shortwave listener. I am a ham operator, and I spy around on the ham bands and on the shortwave bands. When I was into radio, I liked to listen to DX stations on the AM and FM bands. I heard stations like in California from here, like Los Angeles, but they were only the high-powered stations. They weren't the small, low-power stations that we have in various towns. And so my interest in radio was actually when I was growing up. I'd had many different AM, FM radios when I went to school. And then in 1969, I was a shortwave, had my first shortwave receiver where all the bands were jammed together. And I used to listen to VOA and English and the Jazz Hour on Saturday, the only day I could really listen to the Jazz Hour at that time. It's no longer on now. But I was in the Citizens Band Service in like 1969 to 74, And I've always had an interest with talking to people around the world, and Citizens Band was the springboard before I got my ham ticket. And shortwave listening sort of made it where you wanted to talk to people when you heard them on AM or sideband talking back and forth, and it was something that made you want to get into the hobby.
And you obviously are an active amateur radio operator at this time. What's your greatest thrill? What do you say is greatest achievement in the ham field? What's given you the most buzz?
Being able to work around the world, Europe, Japan, Australia, New Zealand, just being able to communicate with those people that know English well enough to send a greeting back and forth, person's name, the call sign, the location, and basically how well they were coming in, and getting the QSL card, which for the people who are not familiar with radio like you are, Steve, it's a card, basically on a stock, card stock. They usually will have a picture of the person that is doing the operating. They'll have the person's name, their call sign, and their address. Sometimes they write a little note on the card saying thank you for the contact. And most of the time, and you'll see, please QSL, which means they would like a card back from you. And people that we work on the air have access to a book that gives our names and addresses, our call signs, and now with the internet, it's on the computer now. And when a person like you, if I were to work you, your call sign, if I heard your call sign, I'd write it down in Braille, and it'd be your name and your location, and how well the signal report would be, how well you were heard, how well I was heard, and that's how a card is put together. And they mail them out all around the world.
And finally, as we begin to wrap up the interview, Ronnie, when did computers come into your life? For instance, for the people, etc. When did that all start for you?
Well, computers came into my life since my brother who died. My oldest brother had a computer up until he died in 2000. His son, who is now in the Navy, used to play around on the computer. He had one, and at one time, his wife at one time worked here and did computer work at the installation, at the Army installation, where she did computer work, I think having to do with recording time when people checked in, checked out, and certain things they had to do on a computer screen at work. So my interest was that I had heard people who were blind had computers, and that they were not hard to work once the software was available, and that got my interest up at the end of middle part of 2001, when I decided I would check into it. The individual who introduced me to it, I met at a grocery store. We were buying groceries, and he said, would you like to get into computers? I see you have a Braille list of your items that you're buying, and he gave me his name, and he said, I work for a computer place 30 miles away, which also is where a school for the blind is here in Alabama. And he gave me his name, gave me his phone number, and we talked about the software and how expensive it is. And at a later time, when my mother was ill, I decided to investigate and check it out. And so that's how I got into it, with his help. And I bought my computer, which has all the screen reading programs in it, like WindowEyes and OpenBook, and the keyboard in Braille, and everything for roughly $4,500, including a desk. And the discouragement was my mother did not really want me to spend a lot of money on it, because she thought it'd be very, very expensive. And when we just, my sister was here, we said, you know, this is something that I could read my mail, read my bills, and handle messages and communication where I could read it. It would not require always having to depend on somebody to read things for me. So that's what took me off in getting my computer.
And now you've got your computer, would it be fair to say that it's revolutionized your life? Has it changed things out of all proportion for you?
Oh yes, I would say definitely so. Without this, the only thing I would be dependent upon, of course, would be radio and television news. And I keep a lot of newspapers and things in my computer now, which are in my favorites, and different websites. And without the computer, I would not be able to read anything for myself, other than having someone to read it out of the paper for me, and otherwise hearing a brief news story on the radio about a news event. So it now gives me the opportunity of being able to read the newspaper, to be able to read the advertisements such as the classifieds, the want ads, the yard sales, and various things that are available in your newspaper, and to be able to also to be able to chat to people like you and others, which I would thought was not possible before.
Yeah, hear, hear. I think we could all echo those sentiments, Ronnie. Finally, can I just ask you, have you got any ambitions left for the rest of your life? Is there anything that you would really love to do which you haven't actually done so far?
Well, at the moment I'm single. I think that the next thing is I own my own home, and I'm in a pretty good job situation that I can retire in a little while. And I think the next thing that I think would be great would be able to maybe settle down and be able to be married to someone, whether or not she had kids, and to be able to have some help with some of the things that I know I'm going to have need of assistance with, and to know that she will, you know, hopefully enjoy church with me as far as religion is concerned, and having a relationship with our Lord and Savior, and being able to do some of the things which will make me less dependent on other people.
And what would you say are you most proud of? What, out of all your achievements, are you most proud of?
I guess I would say the biggest thing I would say I'm proud of and have been happy for is to be able to move out on my own and own my own home, which is the dream of most people. But for handicapped people, as being blind, to be able to set up something where things can be done for you, and to have a sense of independence, being able to go to work, and being able to not necessarily have to live all the time with your mother or your parents, and to be able to contribute something in society, such as your work, being able to pay your taxes, and be able to take advantage of the things that people like us would want to do, and not have to be dependent on the federal government or special things like Social Security checks and things which you would have to qualify for. But to be able to not have to be so dependent upon the government for everything, and being able to earn a living and say that it's something that you've earned and something not given to you.
Well, Ronnie, may I wish you all the very, very best in the future for your ambitions and dreams and hopes. I'm sure you'll realize them. That's the end of the official part of the interview, but I'm sure that if you're agreeable, people have got questions they'd like to ask you. So can I just, on behalf of everyone, thank you very much indeed. I found it absolutely fascinating, and we all look forward to speaking to you in the rooms in the future. Thanks, Ronnie.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Ronnie.
Thank you very much, Steve. I appreciate it very much.
Okay, floor open.
Hello, Ronnie. Well done. Nice hearing you. It's Chris Kant speaking to you. What, if I'm not being so rude as to ask, what is your pay scale? What sort of pay scale are you on? And would, are you on considerably less than the people working in your department, or are you on about the same?
Okay, Chris, I'm on a lower scale than the rest of the people in the shop, in the place where I work. Basically because they are higher grade employees, and because they're higher grade employees, like say a grade 8, grade 9, they make more money. When you go into work, like I went into work 21 years ago, I was under a handicap program, and I'm in a dead-end position because in order to get a higher grade, there are certain responsibilities that you have to meet when you go up to the next grade level and the next. A lot of it is visual and requires, in this case, having to clean parts and do certain things which require vision. When you hire in my job, there are 5 steps in my grade level. They start you off at a minimum. At the time that I started in 20 years ago, it was like $6.50 an hour. And then you would get your next step increase 6 months later after you had been on probation period. They give you a trial period to see that you can do the work. And then I was put on as a career conditional and then a career person. And then you have 5 steps. The second one is 12 months, 6 months after that. Then I think the next one is 6 months or 12 months, and then the remainder, the last 2 steps, 4 and 5, are like 18 months apart. And so the only increase we get is when the federal government gives us a pay increase each fiscal year around July or August or September. And it is based on a cost of living increase. So at where I'm making now, I'm making about $15 an hour. But I will only get a step increase of, say, maybe 30 or 40 cents an hour each year when it comes up. But the other people in my shop are making, the lead man, the supervisors are making more than I would make. But some of them are making $18, $19 an hour or more.
Okay, Ron, thanks very much. I just wondered if you work on a piece rate sort of thing, that you had to do so many an hour, or you had to do so many a day, of, you know, it's all relevant to your pay, but obviously you actually get a basic wage, is that correct?
No, I'm not on a piecework basis. There are other jobs, not out there where I'm working, but in the normal jobs that handicapped people do that may be on a piecework basis. Well, they have to turn out a certain quota, but no, I'm on a salary basis. I get paid by the hour, and we have a production that must be met before the end of each month. Some of it we get, some of it we don't get. Sometimes it slips because we don't get everything in time, but we do the best we can. We build what we have to build each month, but mine is on an hourly basis, and some days I may work a lot, other days I may not work very much at all, but just be there. Someone has to set me up, sighted person has to set me up, and it's up to them to see that I have something to do. But for the most part, yes, it is on an hourly basis.
I used to work in a factory building steering columns for a motorboat, for cars, and it used to be the whole sort of shop area that used to have a collective bonus, where if so many steering columns were obtained, then you used to get a collective bonus that used to be shared among the shop. And I just wondered if it worked that way. Thanks very much, Ron. Nice talking to you.
Okay, thank you very much.
Anyone else with a question for our guest?
Hi, Ronnie, and hi, Steve. It's Ed Burns. I'm not sure what my volume is like, so if I'm too loud or not loud enough, yell at me. What I'm just wondering, because obviously you've been in the same position for 20-some years, you've seen a lot of things happen and things. Just curious how the morale and how things have changed, like ups and downs, as the different, I'll say world conflicts have happened throughout the years. I'm not looking for you to get into anything that's obviously classified. I just mean it more as a general question.
I would say the morale, for the most part, is pretty good at our job. Sometimes we get a little bit frustrated on occasion, I think, because of the fact that work is slow coming in, and sometimes we get pushed sometimes to get stuff out. And of course, we normally get a meeting. We have a meeting about once. We used to have it once a week, letting us know what production is, what we're doing. But sometimes there are things that come up that sort of everybody sort of gets chided now and then for this and that, and sometimes not wearing the safety shoes, and sometimes morale such that somebody may do something and they get on everybody else, you know. It'd be just like any kind of work situation where maybe you didn't do anything wrong, but someone else did, and they have to remind everybody, people leaving early, people not doing their work in a timely fashion, sometimes stretching it out, not doing what they're supposed to do, and with the normal jazz where people sometimes get a little frustrated because they're pushed, and sometimes when we're being able to take it easy, that some people will take advantage of the situation and not do what they're supposed to do. It's a normal run-of-the-mill thing where morale sometimes goes up and down, and sometimes the supervisor, though he would like to do this or that, would like to do something or have a little liberty at giving people a little bit of a sense of calmness and easiness about being lax about certain things. Sometimes he cannot be, and that sort of puts everybody on edge now and then.
Thanks, I appreciate it. And the main reason I asked was, I mean, obviously, being that the military in any country plays an important role, especially one such as the U.S., I thought it was a question that fit the topic well and things like that, so I appreciate you taking the time to answer it for me. And I wish you a good day and best of success in your career and in your recreational activities as well.
Well, thank you very much. I also have to say, being in our job, we get 10 holidays a year. We get, like this coming Friday, well, I'm going to take a day off Friday. I'm going to take an extra day off. But we have Veterans Day, for example. We get off on Monday. We get Thanksgiving Day off. We'll get Christmas and New Year's off when they fall during the week. We'll get Martin Luther King's birthday on the third Monday in January. We get President's Day. We also get Memorial Day when it comes off, the 4th of July, and Labor Day, and Columbus Day. So that's basically our setup.
Okay, looks as if that's a wrap, Ronnie. So thank you very much indeed once more, and wish you the very best of luck.
Thanks a whole lot, Ron. It was a good interview.